Retrograde, Chapter 11. Merrick. Joe is still coughing and clearing his lungs of the last of it. Was it knockout gas? Or was he killed by it? Warmongering humans have developed so many strategies to kill and incapacitate over the centuries, it's no longer easy to know. Nikki hasn't moved. Niccolo. Someone tells him to shut up. But Joe stretches out a hand. Niccolo, destati, destati. His voice almost breaks. His fingertips barely graze Nikki's shoulder before his arms are yanked away. There's blood on Nikki's face and he's not breathing. Destati. Please. Please wake up. Joe hunches over him even as he's kicked again. It's always Italian when Joe doesn't know. Niccolo, destati. Sono qui. Nikki's face is still to the floor, and he grimaces. I am here. Sono qui. With slow, groaning movements, he sits up, still speaking in Italian. But it's not as ancient as Joe feared. Wherever here is. He's not scared, not shocked. He must be old enough to be seasoned in this life. I know as much as you, I'm afraid. Armored Van. Joe stares at the face he knows better than his own. Who are you? What do you know? They caught us on film. Nikki's eyes are tired and shuttered. He scans over the men, their weapons. 2000, he hazards a guess. 2020, Joe confirms the year for him. 2020. Nikki had died in that explosion and gas, gone off to who knows where. Sometimes Nikki will know when a death is coming. He'll suddenly re-examine their surroundings or meet Joe's eyes. Sometimes he even has a chance to say goodbye. But this one had been a shock. When he learns the year, Nikki huffs and frowns. I'm afraid this one will get worse before it gets better, my love. Old, then. Joe watches the expression around Nikki's eyes. Very old. Perhaps older than even Joe is. Joe reaches forward and places a hand on Nikki's knee. Are you okay? He asks in English. A little clue of the language he heard the guard speak. A guard grabs at him. I said shut up, he yells. Don't touch your fucking girlfriend. Nikki pulls one of his small, twisted expressions. This old prejudice, Nikki says. It's so pathetic. It's almost quaint. It's not quaint, Joe bristles. It's childish. He turns to the soldier. As you are a child. Children who have no concept of responsibility, of consequence. You sit here in the presence of a man who has the unimaginable weight of all those things on his shoulders. This man knows what it is to feel grief and loneliness untold. After 1,000 years of killing, his heart is still overflowing with kindness that the world is not worthy of. With your eyes full of hate, you cannot see what is in front of you. Joe looks at Nikki, at his worn expression, but also at the way his eyes crinkle at the sides. This man guards my heart. He has shown that he loves me in 1,000,000 ways, and I can only ache for 1,000,000 more. I love this man beyond measure. Our lives have been folded together, and I choose him every time. He's everything to me. He's more. He always has been. You're an incurable romantic, Nikki says and leans forward. But they are pulled back, pinned across the chest by the soldiers before they are able to touch. Being jostled by the moving truck and the soldiers, Nikki meets Joe's gaze from across the van, and he twitches an eyebrow. Then all hell breaks loose. Nikki pitches a soldier over his shoulder and onto Joe's waiting knee. Joe gets his bound hands around one's neck and cuts into his air supply while the other soldiers rush to their weapons. Joe is stuck for a moment, bearing up under punches as he tries to find a way to incapacitate the rest, but he can't take his eyes off of Nikki. Over hundreds of years of fighting, Joe considers himself adept at killing. More often than not, he walks away untouched, and he fights now with instinct rather than planning, trusting his muscle memory and senses to move quicker than his mind ever could. He's no Andy, but he's good. But today, Nicky is something else. He moves with a speed and lethality that startles Joe. He blocks hits that Joe doesn't even see coming and turns their momentum into moves that incapacitate his attackers. Even in the cramped space of the van, with his hands bound and weaponless, the soldiers can't touch Nicky. Before the man under Joe's hands loses consciousness, the rest of the soldiers are dead. Holy shit, Joe breathes. Nicky's chest heaves. He steps over a fallen man, grabs Joe with his bound hands, and leads him to sit on the bench. He kneels down in front of him and clasps Joe's hands. Listen, Joe, I don't think we have much time. Nicky leans forward and gives him a chaste kiss, just the barest brush of lips. You must be strong. This will not be pleasant. Joe grips Nicky's hands back. I won't let them hurt you. Nicky's expression collapses. You won't have a choice. Do you love me? Yes. Do you trust me? Of course I do. Then let this happen. Nicky moves his hands to Joe's neck. There is so much ahead. I'm sorry I cannot walk the path beside you. Joe squeezes his eyes shut against the tears that sting at him. What do you need? Nicky's face softens like he can't believe the goodness of this man in front of him. I'll need to hear your voice, Nicky says. Keep talking, so I know you are with me. The van stops its rumbling, pulling to a stop and being parked. Joe kisses him again, desperate and hard. I'm always with you, he whispers. The doors of the van open and Nicky drops to the floor, his affect changing immediately to aloof and snarky. I don't suppose it would be possible to get these chains off of us, he quips. They're roughly escorted out of the corpse-filled van at gunpoint. Joe glares daggers at James Copley. They never should have done the repeat. Andy's suspicion at the start was right, and Joe curses at himself. He never should have encouraged her to come back to them in Marrakesh. Nothing good has happened since then. Except perhaps Niall Freeman. Joe remembers when he'd woken up in the train car. His dreams were full of vivid images. What is it? Nicky had asked from his arms, being jolted awake as Joe had spasmed in his sleep. What the fuck? Andy breathed, dragging her hands through her hair, and Booker unscrewed his flask. A dream, Joe said, sitting up and getting a sketchbook. This can't be happening. Andy muttered, not now. Joe was already focusing on his drawing, moving quickly to capture the likeness he had seen. I saw a black woman. Clay Walls, Booker said, his voice gravelly. He gestured with his fingers. Part of a name tag. Free something. Nicky was already grinning, open and free. Yes, he prodded. What else? A Pashtun knife, Joe said. His eyes squinted shut as he tried to hold her features in his mind before his pencil moved across the page again. And a medevac, Booker added. He ran his hand over his throat, face a twisted grimace. I felt her die. Joe looked up in time to see Nicky leaning back against the walls of the carriage, a complicated expression on his face. She's a Marine, Andy said. Combat duty. Or near enough. Afghanistan. She leveled a cold stare at Nicky. Isn't that right, Nicky? He hadn't given her an inch, and Joe had to jump to his love's defense. Leave it, Andy, he'd warned. How often he'd gotten between Nicky and Andromache's blade. How often he'd been too slow. Andy got up and stood over Nicky. Joe pitched his shoulders across Nicky's chest protectively, a physical reminder to Andy that he wouldn't allow much more. What else? She demanded. I cannot tell you, was his soft reply. You know the goddamn mess of a situation we're in here, Nicky, so tell me. You have enough to find her already, he answered. We can't deal with this right now, Booker interrupted. We have to find Copley. We can't leave her alone, Joe protested. If Nikki knows her, then we have to find her. We can find her another day, one when we're not out in the open, Booker said. She's in the open, Joe threw back. He gritted his teeth and went back to his drawing. He couldn't afford to become distracted. Nikki peered over his shoulder at the sketch, then pressed his forehead into Joe's back. He knew her. Of course he did. Occasionally, Nikki had mentioned missing a friend. But that was a long time ago. He hadn't mentioned her for centuries. Could this really, finally, be the person Nikki was waiting for? In truth, Joe was just as desperate to meet her. She sounded wonderful. Andy thumped the train car wall in frustration. What did we do, Nikki? She asked. He sat back, rested his arms on his knees, and linked his fingers together. I don't know. Contrary to popular belief, I don't know everything about our lives, and I haven't lived this one before. He met her eyes, the only one of them that had ever been able to stare Andromache down. But you know what it was like. She needs us. Boss, Booker started, we can't deal with this right now. No, Andy said, her mind made up. We have to. We can't go to ground if there's some marine out there dreaming about us like a homing beacon. She held out her hand. Joe put the finishing touches on his sketch before ripping the page out and handing it to her. Fuck. She's just a baby, Andy said. She'll grow, Nikki promised. There was something in the way Nikki's eyes had lit up when Andy brought Niall into the abandoned church in Goosenville that made something warm curl in Joe's heart. There is a future, Joe reminds himself as he's marched off the plane. This too shall pass. Nikki's presence and reminders are enough for him. But that was a different Nikki, one that woke up in the ambush in South Sudan and died a few scant hours after finally meeting Niall Freeman again. Not this one that seems ancient. Nikki levels his own withering stare at Copley. We expected more from you, Nikki tells him as he has marched at gunpoint to the private jet. You are a wiser man than this. Why are you compromising yourself in this way? Copley doesn't have an answer for him. But Nikki, look at this plane, Joe eggs him on. It's very nice. They are loaded onto the plane, get chained around the ankles, and strapped into their seats, across the aisle from each other and out of reach. For the plane ride across the English Channel, Nikki makes jokes that unsettle their captors but make Joe smirk. Nikki makes an excellent spy. By the time he achieves all the milestones Joe can follow, and even more that Joe can't quite grasp, Nikki's disposition changes. He becomes changed enough that Joe recognizes him as old, and he picks up and discards accents and character traits easily. He knows people well, knows how to push and prod them to do what he wants. He's also endlessly patient and kind, giving chance after chance for someone to change their ways, then admitting to Joe afterwards that he knew they would not change, but he needed to give them the opportunity. In the darkest times, Joe wonders how many times he has infiltrated their own family, subtly steering them this way or that. When the plane begins its descent, Nikki's posture changes. Joe watches carefully as Nikki shifts into a meditative expression. He keeps murmuring words of encouragement in their old dialects. He refuses to answer any questions Joe puts to him, but merely brings up little memories of times long ago. They are transported to a London skyscraper and brought before a weaselly young man who quotes Shakespeare to them and introduces himself as Stephen Merrick. Joe follows Nikki's lead, gives him nothing but a bloodied nose when he gets too close. There's your balance, asshole, Joe spits, even as a gun is shoved in his face. The guards wind him with a knee to the stomach, and he doubles over groaning. Merrick confirms Copley's betrayal in setting them up for the footage of their resurrection. He tends to his nose as he leans against a desk. However, he says. I prefer my evidence firsthand. He attacks Joe with the silver letter opener, stabbing repeatedly into his back and neck. Joe cries out, wincing in pain at the attack. Nikki stays silent. He doesn't yell for him, doesn't draw attention to himself. It's a bargain they made centuries ago on their first visit to Malta. Nikki must never put himself in danger to save Joe. He must always let Joe bear the brunt. Ah, damn it! Shit! Joe feels his wounds stitching together under the doctor's feverish eyes. And a fair few quid to boot, Merrick says. Joe can almost hear him salivating. It always comes down to the money. Nikki is on his knees beside Joe now, close enough that their heads can brush. I'm here, Nikki says with his eyes. I'm with you. For how long? Joe wonders. The others are saying things about research and development now, and Joe can't stand it. He thinks you're a mouse, Nikki, Joe says, trying to provoke a response, any response from Nikki, but nothing comes. There's a cold, twisting weight in Joe's stomach when Nikki doesn't fight the guards as they push him face first to the ground. He's seen this version of Nikki in a fight. They could do some serious damage together here. But Nikki goes willingly. Hey! Hey! Ah! Joe yells as bolts of electricity zap through his muscles and he's pinned down. He's struggling to stay conscious even before they put the injector to his neck and it pinches him. He keeps his eyes on Nikki even as the black fuzzes across his vision. He's doing a strange sort of breathing technique, his mouth open and huffing deep breaths, but his face is calm, even if it is twisted in sympathy against the floor. I'm sorry, Nikki tells him, before it all fades to black. Dr. Meta Kozak considers herself a very practical woman. She has no great love for Merrick, but neither is she blind to the reality of limited funding for her type of cutting-edge scientific research. They are using each other to get what they want. It's a dynamic she is well familiar with. Kozak had done her time in academic research, cramped and underfunded, endlessly tedious with boards and postgrads and bureaucratic nonsense. But here she did groundbreaking work into the telomere extensions and was well on the way with her own passion, preventing cognitive decline with clotho hormones. She had a lab with her own name on it and assistants that were competent, and she could easily fire if they weren't, with many more willing to take their place. She had a seat at the table in directing promising research, not sent off on fool's errands at the whim of public interest and investment. Being at the top of the food chain had the added benefit of finally, insulating her from asshole men who knew the business of science was shaky at best and held that advantage over her. She sunk her life into research. And after she won Merrick's respect, she didn't have to beg or grovel for more funding and resources. It's always about the money. He had come to her with a hypothetical a few months ago, all bouncing feet and waving hands. He told her a story of ageless beings, of cells that heal and reheal instantly. Now, what could you do with genetic code such as that, Dr. Kozak? He asked. Anything. Everything. The degradation of genetic code, she explained, was the cause of aging. And aging was the one thing that had never been able to be tamed. Our cells regenerate, she said, making copies of copies. And eventually, over time, these copies break down. This is why we age, why the elderly take so long to heal from bruises. It's the root of all sickness that cannot be cured. Unless it can be, Merrick said. Months later, he brought her video footage of people rising from the dead, or mostly. She watched as the figures on the ground slowly got to their knees and feet, but one, the male closest to the camera, stayed on the ground screaming until he was shot again, then rose slowly, surrounded by the others. This one, she said, tapping her finger on the white male with the hood. Something is different about him. In the footage, In the last seconds before the female destroys the cameras, the two other males gathered around the third, passing him weapons and speaking too quietly to be picked up by the microphones. Merrick was gleeful when he presented her with samples that were scraped from the floor in South Sudan, and furious when she told him they were contaminated and incomplete. "Not all diseases can be found and cured in the blood," she explained. "I need live bone marrow, liver samples. If you want anything neurological, I'm going to need brain matter, too." That was where her true interest lay, in the way a mind works and reheals. Admittedly, her request became greedy. "Live subjects would be best," she said. "And I would feel more confident if I could take the samples myself." She had no idea that the footage was directed, that they had walked into a slaughter until long after she made her request to Merrick. She cursed herself for not having been more logical, for not having made the connection that if these ageless beings were real, and she didn't know about them, then they didn't want to be found. Then she spoke to one of them on the phone. It was a conference call over some satellite link she knew was untraceable. There were three blinking lights on her computer screen labeled Contact and Subject, and the last being Merrick's personal line. The contact spoke, a rich English accent, responding calmly to Merrick's fury. "What can you get me?" Merrick demanded. The subject's name lit up as a rough voice spoke French into the call. "I can get you one," the contact translated. Merrick addressed her. "Will that be sufficient, doctor?" "Which one?" she'd asked. A picture flashed across her screen, then vanished before she got a chance to save the image. It was a headshot of a white man, early 40s, with sad eyes. She'd imagined a drug being brought to market, a revolutionary drug that could change the world and rebalance power for generations, a drug developed from, and effective only for, middle-aged, white, European men. She shook her head. "No," she said, "I need diversity." The subject spoke again, in French, without needing her words translated, which just confirmed he understood English but refused to use it because he was an asshole. "Perhaps we can get the woman," the contact allowed. "Are you deaf?" Merrick shouted down the line. "We have to have diversity. The Middle Eastern market alone." He'd cut himself off. "I need all of them, or we have nothing, and there is no deal." Kozak was familiar with the feeling of being too deep in it to back out now, and she suspected the two other men on the line felt the same way. This had all started with a hypothetical, a theory Merrick had postulated based on a fairy tale, but these people were real, and it was quickly getting out of hand. But they all wanted something, and nothing is free in this world. They bring the two male subjects from Merrick's penthouse and into her lab. They are dragged between the guards, unconscious, even as they are stripped of their shirts and bound to the testing beds. She snaps on latex gloves and uses alcohol wipes to clean the not insignificant amount of blood from the chest of the white male. Her bin fills up with wadded-up wipes, then her phone rings. She sighs when she reads the name on the screen and answers. "Lizzie, this isn't a good time," she says in a hushed voice. "I know, I'm sorry," comes the tinny voice on the other end. "But it's been a bad day. He was just reading with Katya, and he lost it. Can you speak to him?" "No, I don't," Kozak says, but the phone is already snatched out of her sister-in-law's hand. "Sestra," says her brother, speaking in Ukrainian. "Lanyo!" "Vitalik, I'm at work right now," Kozak answers back in their home language. She drops her voice, even though everyone else in the room is unconscious. "It should be there. It's... ah, fuck." Vitalik releases a stream of words that don't make sense, and she can't follow them. "The fucking thing!" Kozak hears a scold of "language" from Lizzie, even though the swearing is in Ukrainian. They've been raising Katya as bilingual. At least they were, until the diagnosis. "Tell me what you were doing, Breit," Cosette calmly says. I was baking bread, Vitalik answers. He wasn't, Auntie Meta, comes Katya's sweet voice. We were reading in the library.
No,
Vitalik protests, as he does so often these days. There was
bread for the children for lunch, wasn't there, Sestra?
You're confused again, Kozak says. Just let Lizzie handle it. Stubborn silence on the other end, but she is an older sister, and she outwills him. Pichu, pichu, glib, chick, he murmurs. Dit yum na obi chick. It's hesitant and monotone, with no beat or rhythm, but Kozak recognizes it all the same. A childhood song that takes her right back to sitting on her grandmother's floor. I am baking, baking bread for the children for lunch. Kozak rubs her forehead. Mishkist komu minshish. The smaller will get less. Even as she only gives him the next line in the beat, he hisses out of breath. Bilchik komu bilshij. The bigger will get more, he says, his voice less frantic. She imagines him sinking into the big red reading chair in their library that will soon be turned back into a nursery. Together they sing the last line. Sushti pitch, shushti pitch. Dash it into the stove. There's a muffled sound, and Kozak assumes the phone is dropped to the ground before it's picked up by Lizzie. Thank you, Meta. I could never have... He's calmed down now. I'll let you get back to your work. Kozak says her goodbyes and hangs up the phone. She turns back to the gurneys where the subjects are strapped and finds one already awake and watching her. Lanyo, she swears, not expecting to be observed. She recovers quickly. That was a heavy dose for you to shake so quickly. The other one hasn't woken up yet. Is that common? I wanted to speak to you, the subject says. Like that explains anything. Seaglass eyes trace back to where she was speaking on the phone. My Ukrainian is a little rusty, he says. But that was your brother, yes? Yes. He speaks with a soft, calming voice as though she were a child. He does not sound well. This isn't what you're here for, she thinks, but she answers all the same. Alzheimer's. Early onset. He's only 35. The man doesn't acknowledge the straps that bind him to the gurney, the vulnerable position that he and the other one are in. His face is full of compassion. I'm sorry to hear that, he says. That must be difficult for you. There is a genetic component to early onset Alzheimer's, isn't there? Kozak sneers at him. This isn't about me. Let my brain rot for all I care, she flicks a hand. Even if there was a gene therapy program discovered tomorrow, I'm too old. I've made my peace with that. But he has a 4-year-old daughter and a boy on the way. What am I supposed to tell them? That they have 30, 40 good years on this earth and then waste away? That they will carry a curse on to their own children? What sort of a life is that? A good one, the man answers, if they let it be so. The silence hangs heavy in the air before she turns to her instruments. I don't have to justify myself to you, she says harshly. Monitoring systems first, adhering cords to both of their chests and fingers, she takes blood, wiping the inner part of his elbow with iodine as those eyes track her every movement. He stares at her unblinking, and it reminds her of the lab mice she has worked with in the past. When she moves on to taking a tissue sample from the skin and flesh of his bicep, no bigger than a coin, he hisses softly in pain. It surprises her. She didn't think they would feel pain, but not sure what led her to think that. She's in too deep to back out now. And the circle of flesh fills with muscle before her eyes. Before she has even labeled the container, there is nothing there but skin. Remarkable, she murmurs, smoothing over the skin with her latex-gloved hand. The flesh feels firm with no ridges or discoloration, as if she has never made the cut. Would she even be able to access deeper tissue before his skin healed around her instruments? She sinks a long probe into his abdomen, and he twitches and groans. "Do you feel the wound trying to close?" she asks. She certainly can. The friction against the instrument increases the longer it's down there. And just after she has gripped her sample, the pressure increases like the probe is being forcefully extruded. "You will not be able to achieve your goal," he tells her. "I'm sorry." "Science is cumulative," she answers him. "If I am unsuccessful, my research will build up the next generation to find a cure." "No one will." "Not this way." He releases a small grunt as the probe pops free from his skin. "You think I go too far? That I am unethical?" "I would say immoral." "Many unethical people have changed the world for the better," she answers him. "If I am the next in a long line, then so be it." "A fine justification," he allows. A small smile graces his lips. "I have heard it many times before, but they never recognize what it is that truly changes the world." "And what is it then that changes the world other than science?" she challenges him. There is a long pause, and his eyes flutter shut. "Your family is from the Ukraine, yes?" he says. "I was there in 1943. It was such a complicated time in that place. But in the midst of all the confusion and politicking, I met a young woman. She was nothing in the grand scheme of things. A clerk in a Greek Orthodox church." He gives a half smile. "We had many spirited discussions about faith. Her name was Lydia, and she had lost everything. Her brothers were conscripted into the Red Army. Her parents had died in the famine. Her whole family gone. Just like that." Kozak stops her sampling as he talks, and he doesn't stop staring at her. "There was a scheme at the church to distribute baptismal certificates to the Jews in the ghettos. She wasn't the priest baptizing them. She didn't come up with the plan herself, but she was an important part of the story. When the printing paper ran out, she sold all her stockings and lipstick to buy more. She stayed up all night fixing typewriters, just so they could squeeze another day's worth of certificates from them." He sighs, leans his head back and closes his eyes. "Such a small thing. One person doing good despite the odds. But trust me, Dr. Kozak, when I say that is exactly what changes the world." Before she can stop herself, Kozak blurts out, "My grandmother's name was Lydia." He doesn't seem surprised at her admission. Those clear eyes turn to her. It's unnerving, like he's looking directly into her soul. "Is that so?" Joe jerks back to life and consciousness with a tight gasp. Immediately, his eyes are searching around himself even before they can focus. "Nikki," he groans. "Sono qui," comes the answer. Still, Joe doesn't settle until he sees Nikki's face from across the way. Straps and medical equipment are attached to both of them, and he tests their strength. They don't give. Capture. The very thing they fear most. Quinn's face haunts Joe just then, even as he asks after Nikki. "Did you..." he starts, unable to finish. "Still here," Nikki answers. "The lights did not go out. But for how long I can stay, I don't know." Joe flexes his wrists again. Nikki didn't fight it. He must have known this was coming, and he didn't do anything to stop it. "This is what you wanted, was it?" Joe asks furiously. "Captivity? Experimentation?" "Joe," Nikki scolds. One word from him, and it douses the fire in Joe's heart. "Do not accuse me so. I cannot bear it." "Forgive me," Joe begs. "I'm scared." Me too, my heart, Nikki returns. Is this... Joe can't summon the words, so he resorts to euphemism. Have you been here before? Nikki cranes his neck around to more fully look at him. I will need to hear your voice, Nikki says. Joe's heart is in his throat and he chokes on it. The doctor returns. Kozak, Merrick had called her. She's silent as she takes a blood sample from Joe, then flesh and tissue. Apropos of nothing, from Joe's perspective, Kozak turns to Nikki and crosses her arms. The plan didn't rest on Lydia's shoulders, she says, and Joe's eyebrows rise. If she didn't do those things you say she did, it would have been someone else. But it was her, Nikki replies simply. She saw the chance to do good, true good, and she took action. Even in those small ways, I have always admired people such as her. The whole conversation leaves Joe confused, but Nikki clearly has a plan. He leans up as much as he can in his restraints. You can still follow in her footsteps. There is always a chance. I don't know how we escape these chains, but I know that we will. Perhaps you will be the one who releases us. You can still do some good, something that truly changes the world. There is a long pause. Then her face hardens. Bone marrow next, I think, she says. After hours, her little jars are filled with samples, and Joe has sweated and soaked through the scratchy paper sheet under him. Still, Nikki speaks to the doctor, prompting her along and prevailing on her good nature with gentle words. She leaves the lab for a minute, taking a sample for more thorough examination. She doesn't deserve your kindness, Joe says, keeping his eyes on the ceiling. It's grace. No one deserves it, Nikki returns. You don't get to decide who receives it. The weight in Joe's gut feels sour. I hate this. I hate it so fucking much. He turns his head towards Nikki. We get out, right? Nikki raises an eyebrow at him. Of course we do, then he smirks. You still haven't had me for the first time yet. Joe lets out a loud laugh. Don't think I've forgotten that, he says with a grin. I've been looking forward to it for over 700 years. The change in Dr. Kozak comes not long after that. She's cursing under her breath, obviously unsatisfied with what she sees in the microscope. She pulls out a walkie-talkie and speaks into it. Keen, could I please have two men in the lab for transfer? Transfer? Joe demands. Transfer where? Relax, Kozak says, pulling forward a different bed on wheels. It has a head brace, one that opens and shuts to keep the head in position. A brace to pin a chest down, and a gap down the middle that can expose a spine. I'm not going to separate you. Yeah, you'd better not, Joe threatens, ice in his voice. There will be no grace or mercy from me if you do. Kozak, along with the two soldiers, pull up the new bed alongside Nikki's and lock the wheels. They pin him down with arms around his neck and limbs, and a gun in his face for good measure. He goes willingly enough, and they strap him down with new restraints. It's a turning table, one that totally immobilizes Nikki. Just before his head is strapped down, he looks at Joe and whispers, Just your voice, Joe. That's all I need. Once he's strapped down securely, Kozak flips him over onto his front, exposing the long line of his back. Kozak prepares a long, thick needle. It is slipped right into his spine and his lower back, and Nikki screams. Clear fluid fills the syringe, and Joe has a few more choice words for her. Neural tissue, too, Kozak says. Nikki, I'm here, Joe says. I'm not going anywhere. She wipes iodine on the nape of Nikki's neck. Anywhere I am, you are, Nikki says. That's it. That's it exactly, Joe says. What am I, Nikki? You're constant. You're my rock. Another instrument is aimed at the bottom of his skull. Goodbye, my love, says Nikki,
No,
Joe shouts. He screams himself hoarse. Nikki shakes and shudders as the needle sinks into his brain. Then he goes limp. The guards spin Nikki's bed back over so he faces the ceiling. He doesn't move even as they unstrap his head. The heart monitor reads flatline and Joe can't bear it. Niccolo, he calls gently. You're dismissed, Kozak says to the soldiers. Joe can't look away from Nikki's face. He still isn't moving. There's no change in the monitors. Niccolo, I'm here, Joe says gently. There's nothing. It wasn't a big wound. It shouldn't be taking this long to heal. He should be awake. Niccolo, wake up. Wake up. I'm here. You've got to... Nikki, wake the fuck up. Even Kozak looks concerned. She pauses at her instruments and watches the heart monitor, but Joe couldn't care less what she thinks. Niccolo, his voice cracks. You promised me. The monitor beeps just once. Thank fuck. Niccolo, destati. Sono qui con te. Non avere paura. Joe can get his shoulder half off the bed. The straps pinch at his wrists and elbows as he strains. Nikki gasps awake, his muscles seizing against the straps. He thrashes, and Joe almost fears a seizure until Nikki opens his eyes and speaks. It's that ancient Ligurian, heavily accented. He's terrified. He's begging Mother Mary for salvation, for death. He can't get a full, coherent sentence out. A sharp, acrid smell fills the air. He's pissed himself. Niccolo, here I am, Joe shouts. Nikki's eyes finally focus on the world around him. His skin is ashen white, and his eyes are wet and scared when he finally turns his head to see Joe. There is no recognition on his face. He's looking at Joe like they are strangers. Niccolo, it's okay. It's going to be okay. Niccolo's face contorts and he begins to weep. Big hot tears track down his face. He calls out for his mother, and he has never seemed so young before. Extraordinary, Dr. Kozak says. She sees the change in him and draws the wrong conclusion. It seems that damaging the brain matter of the cerebellum while the body is still intact brings upon an Alzheimer's-like state. This experiment bears repeating. The secret of their immortality is already exposed. Joe will carry the secret of Nikki's recursive life to the grave, after a few thousand years of torture if he has to. What Merrick and those like him would do with Nikki's curse, the sabotage and spy work and secrets of the future he would uncover. It is Joe's greatest fear. 300 years ago, in a tenement building in Edinburgh, Nikki had grabbed at strands of his hair and said, "They shaved my head." Now Kozak brings a pair of clippers to join the rest of the instruments on her tray. Niccolo, I am with you, Joe says in the language of his lover's childhood. No matter what happens, I'll be with you. Niccolo's eyes widen as though he hears the words like a threat. Dr. Kozak grabs Niccolo's head and begins shaving. Niccolo sobs through it as locks of brown hair drop to the ground. Please, Lord, I beseech thee, in the hour of my death, he murmurs. Joe is spitting insults at her, begging her to stop. He's had enough. Leave him be, Joe roars. Use me.
Receive me with joy into the arms of thy mercy, through Christ my Lord. Amen.
Niccolo is forcing his prayer through tears. When the doctor is done and Niccolo is shaved bald, she straps his head back down to the turning bed. Joe can't meet his eyes again. There's a chasm between them, and Joe can't stretch across it. The bed is spun over again, but Kozak doesn't go for Nikki's spine this time. She wields a small scalpel and slices under the skin at the nape of his neck. Niccolo, it's going to be all right, Joe says as Nikki screams. You'll be safe soon. I promise you that. There is no mercy, no anesthetic. She slices into the skin and muscle until a large flap is revealed and she peels it back. There is his smooth skull, bloodied, white, and exposed. Niccolo still hasn't died.
Niccolo, I will find you. I'll keep you safe.
He's babbling and drooling. He doesn't talk to Joe. It's just begging. A nightmare, Nicky had thought at first. He couldn't understand the start of his unnatural life as anything but damnation. How could any crusader make sense of medical torture in a white, sterile lab in the 21st century? A stranger's voice with the face of his enemy that calls his name and makes impossible promises. Niccolo begins to pray,
Pater Noster.
But he can't get any further. He's stuck in his terror as he cries out,
Pater Noster, Pater Noster.
A desperate plea, our Father, and he can't summon any more words. Kozak cleans Nikki's skull of blood and picks up a medical drill. Joe can't scream at her anymore. All he can do is help a desperate former priest pray for mercy.
Pater Noster, Joe cries out to Niccolo, qui es in calis?
Si, si. It's the first sign of the man that isn't pure terror. With this jolt to his memory, Niccolo is able to continue.
Sanctificetur nomen tuum.
Adveniat regnum tuum, Joe says, just as Kozak finds her angle and turns on the drill.
Fiat volunt,
and then Niccolo expires again.
You bastard! You slimy piece of shit! Joe roars at Kozak. I will kill you, you motherfucker! I'll make you suffer, and no amount of begging will stop me.
She's tuned him out, working methodically on the exposed part of Nikki's brain, taking samples from the surface and further in. Already the skull is creeping closed.
You won't be able to get what you want. All you are doing is torturing a good man and signing your own death warrant. I will see to it, Joe promises darkly.
The heart monitor beeps and finds a steady, slow pace even as Nikki's brain is exposed. The flap of skin slides closed over the hole Kozak is drilled.
Lanyo, she swears.
She steps away from Nikki, flipping the bed back over so he rests on his back and taking the brain matter samples with her. Nikki gasps awake even as blood continues to drip to the floor.
Niccolo, Niccolo, Joe chants.
His head is still pinned and immobile.
Joe?
Nikki croaks.
Where?
I'm here, Joe rushes to say. Fuck, his whole body is trembling. We're in Merrick's lab, 2020.
Again?
Nikki asks. He can't turn his head even as Joe stares at his profile. It feels like I was just here, not 6 months ago. Joe feels tired and wrung out, and apparently he'll see Nikki die at least one more time before this resolves. The curve of Nikki's head looks awfully fragile without hair. Joe's never seen him shaven down. Nikki's never wanted to, and now Joe knows why. Nikki's nose twitches.
What's that smell?
You wet yourself. Nikki flexes his hips against the restraints and grimaces.
That would have been,
Nikki starts.
That was one of my firsts.
Yeah, Joe says. I figured that.
You know what, Yusuf? Nikki says. Fuck this year.
Joe laughs and flops back onto his bed.
I agree, Nikki, Joe says. Fuck 2020.
What Kozak finds in Nikki's brain matter infuriates her.
It's nothing, she says. Nothing in your gray matter I haven't seen before. No evidence of decay.
Unremarkable, am I? Nikki asks. Youngish, Joe clocks him as. Younger and cheeky. Or perhaps he is just trying to cheer Joe up after what he witnessed in one of Nikki's first resurrections. Either way, they're not discussing it in front of her.
You know how much this means to me, she says to Nikki. What happened before? You weren't yourself. It was like you regressed.
Nikki's face remains impassive.
Forgive me. I do not feel like being on speaking terms with someone who has cut out parts of my brain.
Kozak recoils, evidently aware that whatever goodwill Nikki held for her was spoiled by her own actions. She takes it as though she has been scolded and retaliates like a child.
Well, she says, if your cells don't hold promising data, then perhaps his will.
and she turns her attention to Joe. Nikki, true to the promise he made in Malta, never interrupts Kozak as she pulls Joe apart. She opens up his chest cavity and Joe is still living when she observes entire systems in operation. Joe flatlines at least 3 times under her knife and loses consciousness many more times. Joe counts it as 3 lives he saved Nikki from living. She doesn't shave Joe's head as she takes a neural sample. Nikki arches an eyebrow and says it's the only wise choice she's made all day. Joe laughs even as the probe is inserted into his spinal column. She places 2 IV lines, 1 in each of Nikki's arms. "If I can just catch it in the act," Kozak says, hooking up a chemical concoction to one. On the other end, she places an empty bag that slowly starts filling up with blood. She places a squishable stress ball in Nikki's hand. "Squeeze this, if you please." The ball drops to the floor. "Oops," Nikki says, deadpan. Joe stifles his laugh. Kozak bends to the floor to fetch the ball. When she presses it to Nikki's hand again, his fingers are slack and the ball rolls out again. She huffs and mutters under her breath as she takes her measurements around them. Nikki meets Joe's eye. His wordless expression is enough again to set Joe off chuckling again. "Do you remember that time in the Philippines?" Joe asks, trying desperately to pull his own weight and bringing a little levity to their dire situation. 2003? Nikki shakes his head. "Booker was taken by a gang. They took him out and gave him a shovel, told him to dig his own grave, remember?" Joe says, knowing that he doesn't. "Did he refuse?" Nikki asks. Joe drops his voice to a gravelly approximation of the Frenchman. "If these are my last moments on Earth, I'm going to live as I always have, avoiding manual labor." "Then he killed them with the shovel," Nikki hazards a guess. "Then he killed them with the shovel," Joe agrees. Nikki laughs, his eyes squinting shut. He dozes off for a short while, the chemicals and bloodletting draining his energy dry. After a minute, he works his mouth and finds it slow to move.
"Are you all right, Joe?" Nikki asks, his voice slurs. "You're distressed."
Joe squeezes his eyes shut against the prickle of tears. "It's been a very long day." Nikki dies again and wakes up slow and confused. Joe has to tell him the year, the fact that they're captured and tortured, and hear Nikki panic. Kozak sees that brief confusion and pounces on Nikki. She rolls him away for a CT scan, and Joe spends a full hour alone and shivering in that lab, his mind whirring through the worst-case scenarios. Nikki has been transferred back to the normal testing bed and even been cleaned of urine and given fresh pants, and Joe briefly, foolishly, hopes that will be the end of the testing on Nikki's brain. Dr. Kozak tightens the straps across Nikki's body so he can't even tremble. She rolls a chair to sit at Nikki's head. "I don't," she starts, almost apologetic in tone. "I don't mean to make this more painful than it should be. You have both already proved to heal faster under the effects of sedatives, and I need time to access what I need." "Delusional," Joe thinks. So, without anesthesia, she cuts again into Nikki's head. She's prepared this time. She pins and clamps down the flaps of skin and takes a bone saw to the exposed bloody skull. Both Nikki's and Joe's screams can be heard over the machinery. A block of bone the size of a hand is removed. Kozak drops it on her tray and it rocks there. She goes into Nikki's brain with her probes and scissors. "It's okay," Nikki says. "No, it's not," Joe shoots back, straining against his ties. "Hey, Yati. There is no nerves. It doesn't even hurt, Joe. I'm okay. I'm okay." It does nothing to calm Joe down. He's furious and quickly growing exhausted. A flat line again, and another version of his love dragged from who knows where and thrown into this hellhole. Joe talks to him, even sings, anything to keep Nikki calm and getting through this.
He doesn't last long. Kozak grows frustrated at the creeping bone and flesh and recuts along her old marks. Nikki cries out and dies again. Joe, just as he said he would to that ancient version of Nikki, keeps talking. When Nikki calls him Yusuf, he uses Arabic, and when he cries out for Osip, he speaks to him in Russian. Joe hasn't had a sip of water since Goosenville, and its mouth is dry and croaky, but he doesn't stop talking. 5, maybe 6 lives are passed on the table under Kozak's knife. Each one is upset and tries to escape, the straps ripping deep into their skin. Then they realize it's futile and try hard as they can to speak back to Joe and comfort him in return. Once, Kozak slices a part of Nikki's brain on the left. It bleeds heavily, and the words come out jumbled. It's a mess of articles and tense markers in different languages. At first, Joe almost understands him. Then strange words creep in, and eventually all Nikki can do is repeat nonsense phrases and smile when Joe talks. Afterwards, when his brain is left alone and heals over, Nikki tries to reason with Dr. Kozak. "Do you know how many years I have lived?" he asks her. "Nikki, don't talk to her," Joe warns. "No," Kozak answers. "Why not?" Nikki asks. "That is data, relevant to your research, isn't it?" "All right," Kozak plays along. "How old are you?" Nikki grins. "I no longer remember how old I am. You know, before trains and telegrams and accurate clocks, we never used to mark the days by minutes. Work began when the sun rose, and it was harvest time when the crop was ready. I no longer use years. I consider my age in terms of milestones, things I have seen and achieved. When we go to the stars, even the 12-month calendar, as old as Caesar, will not last." Joe stays silent. "Why are you telling me this?" Kozak asks. "Because something you think of as essential as the world marching to the rhythm of a second hand is not unchangeable," Nikki answers her. "If you are wrong about the fundamentals of time such as this, what else are you wrong about?" There's another 3 deaths on the table each, and Joe is bone tired. He's forcing himself to stay awake, not willing to leave Nikki awake and alone, and even more unwilling when he's asleep and defenseless. Joe doesn't know how much more he can take, and Nikki knows it. "This is worse for you," Nikki tells him in the brief hours of the night they have respite from Dr. Kozak. "I don't think it is," Joe says. It is the only way they are able to make their grand love story over centuries work, by competing to outlove, outserve, and outcare for each other. "You're going through this alone. For you, it's cumulative," Nikki says. "I have respite. Hell, we were swimming in the sea 2 days ago." A slow grin spreads over Joe's face. "That sounds nice." Nikki cricks his head around and watches Joe's face carefully. "In truth, I cannot imagine living my life in one straight line anymore. Is that strange?" Joe considers his answer carefully. "We are, if anything, adaptable," he allows. Nikki smiles, a blush that should have lost its charm hundreds of years ago on his cheeks. "Every time I die, I run the risk of coming back here, but I can bear up under it for a time. I'm sorry you have to go through it all at once." "After all this time, I still don't know how you do it," Joe says. "How you go into death without any idea of what you'll find on the other side." Nikki's hand twitches and flexes, like he's reaching out for Joe. "That's not true," Nikki says. "I always have you. Wherever I am, you are." Joe swallows around the lump in his throat. "I'm always with you, my heart." Nikki's soft smile is always something Joe treasures. "Get some sleep, love. I will be here when you wake." They've been there a day and a night, and part of a day, by Joe's reckoning. He's lost time himself in the dying and returning, but at least his hours are in the right order.
Dr. Kozak has moved on from small samples. Now she's cracking them open and taking larger and larger chunks. She's getting desperate. Deaths come faster despite their best efforts. There are only so many organs they can survive without. Joe hasn't heard anything about the others, but the two beds to their right show that Merrick is at least hopeful. They'll come for them. They'll escape. Nikki promised. Everything changes after she takes Nikki's heart. Kozak leaves with the still twitching muscle on a sterile tray. She doesn't need to see him revive anymore. Nikki wakes up silently, even as his chest is healing over and his sternum cracks into place. His head moves slightly side to side, trying to orientate himself. Nikki starts softly crying. "I'm here, Nicolo," Joe calls out softly in Ligurian. Nikki's head bends quickly around towards him, his eyes wide and wet. "Yusuf!" "We're in Merrick's lab, 2020, Joe recites again, as he has for all the rest of the deaths. "Earth?" Nikki asks. "How is that even a question?" "Yeah, London," Joe says after a thought. He tacks on, "England." "Yusuf, I don't understand," Nikki says. "We've been here for a full day, maybe more," Joe explains patiently. But even as he speaks, he realizes something is wrong. "Andy, Booker, and Niall are going to get us out." "No, that's..." Nikki's expression is complicated, and he's looking to Joe for all the answers. "I was..." Joe sits halfway up. "Nicolo, what's wrong?" "I was aging," Nikki whispers. "I wasn't supposed to wake up." Joe's heart drops through to his gut. You were dying?" "I thought I had made it to the end," Nikki says. I thought there were no blanks left for me to fill. That I'd done it all." He looks away, searching his memory. "I must have been wrong. Perhaps this is the end for me. Maybe this life. Maybe the next." He's speaking Italian, but it's with an accent Joe can't recognize, not with all his years of experience. "I should be dead," Nikki mutters. "Nicolo." Joe's heart is breaking. He's thrashing against his restraints and he can't fucking touch Nikki. "Nicolo, don't say that," he begs. "Don't say those things." "No, it's okay," Nikki says, his eyes shining. And he's smiling at him. "I'm okay. I'm ready to die. It's my time." A sob escapes Joe. "I can't lose you," he gasps. Nikki's face is full of compassion. "You won't. Oh, Yusuf. What was it, 2020? You still have so much more to go." However old the version of Nikki was in the van, this one is immeasurably more ancient. Joe is crying now, but all Nikki can do is stare at him with an amazed smile. "You are so beautiful," Nikki says in awe. Joe gasps a laugh through his hot tears. "I'm going to get you out of here," Joe vows. "I will make sure you're safe and spend the next millennia giving you the world." "My heart," Nikki says. "You have done all that and more." Joe uses his shoulder to wipe the tears from his face, as ineffectual as it is, and takes a moment to compose himself. Nikki hasn't looked away, like he can't bear to part his eyes from Joe's face. You were really at the end?" Joe asks. Nikki nods. "I thought I got lucky, living out the end at the end of my life. One small mercy, like a mirror to my life before immortality. Turns out I was just wrong." "I wish I could hold you, light of my life," Joe says, tugging pointedly at his bindings. "I wish it too." Nikki angles his head against the bed and looks at Joe with an expression that is so unbelievably fond. Joe can hardly bear it. There's a few moments of quiet, then Nikki's eyes turn misty again.
"Oh, I have missed this," he says. "I have missed you."
The words land in Joe's ear like an off-key chord. Nikki's head is still turned at an angle to stare at Joe, and he doesn't seem like he'll look away anytime soon.
"Niccolo, tell me I didn't leave you."
Joe speaks, his voice dark and heavy.
"Tell me I didn't leave you alone."
Nikki's face contorts.
"You are here, aren't you?"
"No, you didn't leave me." A sob escapes him.
"I left you. Forgive me, my own."
"Afir el-ai arjuk habyun."
It's impossible and unthinkable. It cannot be true. "What are you saying, Niccolo?"
"I should have followed you," Niccolo confesses. "I should have followed you the moment you died in my arms and didn't wake. Yotuf, I wanted to. But there was so much work to do. They needed me, Yotuf. They were so young. I had to teach them."
Yotuf. It's not a name Joe has ever heard before, but he hears the echoes of his own in it. Joe latches onto it, the only thing that he can rationalize and grasp from what Niccolo is saying.
"I could have," Niccolo continues. "I could have passed right there with you. I checked. I wasn't healing. I was aging. I could feel it, Yotuf. But you wouldn't let me leave them."
"Niccolo," Joe groans.
"I gave myself 20 cycles without you, enough to pass on what I've learnt. I have missed you so much. So often I've dreamed of your face. I wanted to hear your voice just one last time."
He looks away.
"Maybe this was a kindness, a chance for me to see you again before I die."
"I'm here," Joe says, but he feels far away, like the world has shifted under his feet and thrown him far from his love. He's summoning the energy to say something more when the doors to the laboratory open and Dr. Kozak returns.
"Stay silent, Niccolo," Joe begs. "Endure and survive. We can speak again soon."
Niccolo obeys, tilting his head back towards the ceiling. Mercifully, Kozak doesn't stay long. She doesn't even begin a new round of testing. She receives a call and quickly exits the lab, leaving the two of them alone again.
"You know, I was thinking about Malta," Niccolo says. "I would so love to go there again."
"We will," Joe promises. Niccolo's smile is tight-lipped.
"Of course," he says.
"No," Joe wants to scream.
"I meant with you. I will take this aging Nikki at the end of his life and give him nothing but joy until the end."
Nikki looks around the lab.
"I've been here before," he says slowly.
"Yes," Joe confirms. "Many times." Niccolo hums.
"By the end of it, we had figured out some of how my traveling worked. I tend to stay within chapters or eras of my life. It has been so long since I was here at this point."
"This can't be true," Joe says, shaking his head. "How can you be here if you lost your immortality?"
"Another thing we were able to learn," Nikki says. "My mind and body are quite separate. My body was finished. I thought my mind was, too. But I must be near the end now. I can feel it. Perhaps the next death will be my last."
"No," Joe groans.
"It will be okay, Yotuf. You told me before you died that I ended very well. You gave me your blessing to continue on."
Niccolo's voice is lilting.
"You had a good death. You'll be proud to die it."
"Were you," Joe asks, "were you okay?" Niccolo smiles kindly at Joe.
"I tell you how you die for the final time, and you are not at all concerned about yourself. You only ask after me. You are the most incredible, caring man. That's why I love you.
Niccolo's hand is straining towards Joe again as Dr. Kozak reenters.
Doctor, please, Joe begs as she moves quickly through the lab. Please let me go to him. You can keep me chained if you wish, but he needs me. Please, doctor, let me touch him.
Kozak looks at him in sympathy and hesitates.
I'm sorry. I'd love to, but I just don't have time right now. They're bringing in the others.
Joe's blood runs cold. Niccolo sits up, his face so open.
The others? He asks.
Kozak just shakes her head and prepares the straps on the other two beds. Not half an hour later, the doors of the laboratory burst open, and a string of guards marches in, holding between them, handcuffed and staggering.
Sebastian! Niccolo cries. Andromache! I am so pleased to see you!
What's wrong with him? Booker asks.
He is feeling his years, Joe answers.
Niccolo's eyes are tracking Andy closely, totally enamored with her, as she is led to the bed and bound to it. Joe sees it too.
Andy, he says, your side. She's not healing, Booker grunts. I killed her.
It wasn't you, Nikki says, as Kozak pulls Andy's shirt out of the way. Joe collapses to the bed at the sight of the blood still wet and seeping.
Mortal. Andy is mortal.
Joe can't bear this day anymore.
He's tired. He's adrift. He wants out. For the first time in his long life, Joe wants to put a bullet to his head and wake up somewhere else.
Kozak is talking to the CEO, that man called Merrick who demanded answers to their immortality, and he's making more demands again.
All things die, Niccolo says with the wisdom of the ages.
Merrick narrows his eyes.
What was that? Everything has to die, mister.
Niccolo trails off, a question in his tone. Merrick has spent years vainly trying to prove himself capable and make an impression. He is not a man who is accustomed to being forgotten.
Merrick. Stephen Merrick. We met just yesterday.
He grits out. As you say, Niccolo replies, a sardonic eyebrow raised that never fails to make Joe laugh and fall in love again. Except today, where it is painfully familiar, yet distant all at once.
Niccolo turns and looks at Andy and Booker. It is wonderful to see your faces, he says tenderly. I so wanted to see you again.
Booker looks stricken to the bone by those words.
Mr. Merrick,
Niccolo turns his face back to their captor.
Nothing that lives can live forever. If it is now Andromache's time, if it is mine, nothing you can do will stop it. I have made peace with that. Have you?
Niccolo, don't waste your time with him, Joe murmurs.
Merrick glares at him. We have plenty of time. I will take slices off you for years to get what I want.
You won't get what you want.
This is what time is. It is unyielding, and you cannot fight against it, Niccolo says harshly.
He can be endlessly kind or ruthless. His passion and ferocity that are so dear to Joe's heart have been honed to a fine blade, and Niccolo wields that blade with fury.
Nothing you build here will stand, but we will. You are nothing but a speck, insignificant, forgotten.
Shut up, Merrick demands. Niccolo barrels on, shining bright as the sun.
We will never be forgotten. My people will still be living and breathing and fighting long after your name has been scrubbed from the history of Earth. I have already seen to it.
I said, Merrick screams, grabbing a knife from Kozak's tray,
shut up!
No, Joe roars. Merrick brings the knife down into Niccolo's neck, chest, eye, again, again, again. Joe is screaming. He throws himself so hard against his bindings that the bed tilts and slams him sideways against the floor. Blood is flowing down from Niccolo's bed, dripping into puddles on the floor where Joe's arm is outstretched. His fingers smear through the thick red, and the blood is still warm. There is so much noise above him, voices raised, Andy and Booker shouting, guns being loaded, boots squeaking against the floor. But the only thing Joe can hear is the heart monitor's steady drone of flatline. To be continued.